correct about where we are? I mean, we were on slide 7, right? But that's where I stopped. But I did finish that, basically. Okay. Let's proceed then to 8. And 8 looks similar to one that we already looked at. The difference here is that now we're looking at the parasympathetic division rather than the sympathetic division. And notice the difference with respect to the wiring, the connections. Remember where the sympathetic division connected to the central nervous system? Yeah, you can at least answer, no, I don't remember. Thoracic and lumbar regions of the spinal cord, correct. And notice that the thoracic and lumbar regions are not being connected to by the parasympathetic division. Instead, the parasympathetic division connects, part of it connects to the brain, as you see on the top, and part of it connects to the sacral region, right here. So that's one difference with respect to anatomy or how it's wired. Compared to the sympathetic division, that is. But the other difference, and I kind of mentioned this last time, is with respect to autonomic ganglia. Do you remember the three types of autonomic ganglia? No, thank you. All right, don't look. Yeah, they're all autonomic ganglia. How many types are there first? That's the easier question. 3, yes. It has been 2 days. Collateral ganglion is one type. Chain ganglion, another type. And terminal ganglion, right. So those are the 3 overall autonomic ganglia. Now, we already talked about 2 of those last time, right? Because the chain ganglia and the collateral ganglia are the ones in which sympathetic preganglionic neurons synapse with sympathetic postganglionic neurons. All right, so those are the 2 of the overall 3 autonomic ganglia. The 2 that the sympathetic division uses for its connections are the chain ganglia and the collateral ganglia, which is why the chain ganglia are called the sympathetic chain ganglia. Okay? So, back to this original statement I was trying to make. Another difference between sympathetic and parasympathetic division is that the ganglia that are used to make the synapses, or at which the synapses occur between parasympathetic preganglionic neurons and parasympathetic postganglionic neurons, are the terminal ganglia, the 3rd type of autonomic ganglion. And terminal ganglia, meaning at the end, terminal means at the end, are so named because they occur very close to the target tissue, whatever it is. And so hopefully this makes sense to you hopefully it will make sense that what this means, since the terminal ganglia are close to the target tissue, is that in the parasympathetic division, the preganglionic neuron is much longer than the postganglionic neuron. Because the preganglionic neuron has to go from central nervous system to the terminal ganglion, which is right by the target tissue. And then that postganglionic neuron just has to make the short distance from the terminal ganglion to the target tissue itself, very nearby. Okay? So that's another anatomical difference. All autonomic wiring has 2 neurons in series, a preganglionic and a postganglionic. The connection point is made at a ganglion. In the sympathetic division, there are relatively shorter preganglionic neurons and relatively longer postganglionic neurons, because those postganglionic neurons have to go from either a chain ganglion or a collateral ganglion to the target tissue. Okay? In the parasympathetic division, the preganglionic neuron is much longer than the postganglionic neuron because it has to go all the way from central nervous system to terminal ganglion, and it's very close to the target tissue already, so the postganglionic neuron is short. Does all that make sense spatially in your mind? I don't know how well it's illustrated here. They're just showing you various organs that are being innervated by the parasympathetic division. But this is not really an anatomical, you know, things aren't really in the place where they would be with respect to the central nervous system. So it's, you don't really get a feel for the proximity of the terminal ganglia to the tissues themselves. In 9, though, slide 9, we have a table that summarizes these major differences. And let me just make sure I've mentioned all this to you. Well, origin in the central nervous system. Thoracolumbar simply means in the thoracic or lumbar region of the spinal cord. So it's just another word to say what I've already told you. Whereas craniosacral for the parasympathetic division means it connects either to the brain, cranial, or sacral region of the spinal cord. I just got done telling you about the location of the ganglia. And I think I told you last time that another name, well, let me pose it as a question. What is another name for collateral ganglia? Where are collateral ganglia located? Well, yes, they are definitely peripheral nervous system. That's what makes them ganglia. Prevertebral, exactly. When you look at the picture, which I think was the slide we ended with last time, yeah, these collateral ganglia, notice they're lined up more or less right on the midline, which would be in front of the vertebral column, if you could see the vertebral column. And therefore, they're called prevertebral. Whereas another name for the chain ganglia is paravertebral. So that's why those words occur in this table. Paravertebral ganglia are chain ganglia. Prevertebral ganglia are collateral ganglia. Just another word, just another pair of words for those. Whereas it's terminal ganglia near or within even target organs for the parasympathetic division. And so the fiber lengths I just got done talking about, it's short and long versus long and short. And neural divergence I did not really talk about, so I'm glad I bothered to read this table. What is divergence? Right, branching outwardly. And I talked a little bit about divergence with respect to the autonomic nervous system as a whole. Well, the sympathetic division, as you see, has extensive divergence. And this is why output of the sympathetic division, which means firing of preganglionic neurons, can have widespread effects in the body on many different organs, many different tissues at the same time, because each of those preganglionic neurons branches and therefore activates several different postganglionic neurons that are going to different targets. All right? That's what divergence gives you. There's not nearly as much divergence in the parasympathetic division, so that means the effects of the parasympathetic division, this last row, are more local and more specific. They're affecting just one or two targets rather than many at once because there's less divergence, right? The message is just going to certain recipients rather than broadcasting it to a lot of recipients. Okay, let's go to 10 and talk some more about neurotransmitters. First of all, neurotransmitters are examples of signals. They're not the only signals the body uses, but they are signals. They're signal molecules, right? Signals are molecules that cause something to happen that wouldn't happen if the signal weren't there. And this is why signals carry information. They cause things to happen that wouldn't in their absence. But, like I said, neurotransmitters are not the only signals. What are some other kinds of signals? What do we call signals that aren't neurotransmitters? Did you say something? Hormones are examples of signals as well, correct. And there's no chemical distinction necessarily. In other words, a hormone is not called a hormone because it's some sort of chemical, and a neurotransmitter is some other kind of chemical. I think I've already told you, in fact, that the same chemical can act as a hormone in one instance and a neurotransmitter in another instance. This is true, for instance, for norepinephrine, which is what the NE stands for here. Norepinephrine is acting as a neurotransmitter if it's released from a neuron and only is released right there at that tiny little location where the synapse is, and therefore has its effect only on that downstream tissue, whatever that is. Okay, that's exactly the same chemical as norepinephrine that's released by the specialized neurons that make up the adrenal medulla that we were talking about last time. But those ones, even though it's exactly the same chemical, those norepinephrine molecules aren't just released onto the tissues that are immediately there. Instead, those molecules are put into the bloodstream, and they therefore are broadcast throughout the body because all the living cells receive blood. All right, so it's not a chemical distinction as to whether something is a neurotransmitter or a hormone. It's a functional distinction. But the reason I'm mentioning all this is because whatever the function is, whether it's a neurotransmitter or a hormone or even subclasses of those that we'll talk about in 202, no matter what kind of chemical signal it is, in other words, functionally speaking, it's not going to have any effect on the target tissue, on any tissue, unless what occurs? No, there doesn't have to even be an action potential involved. Yes, there has to be a receptor of the right shape, and therefore the right type, to be able to receive, which is why it's called a receptor, that signal molecule. So any chemical signal operates by temporarily binding to a receptor for that specific type of signal. And therefore, signals are a specific example of what type of particles, since they are binding to something else. They're ligands, exactly. Chemical signals are ligands. Okay, so this was true on the first neurotransmitter we talked about, which was what? Acetylcholine. We talked about that in terms of the neuromuscular junction between a motor neuron and a skeletal muscle cell. Acetylcholine was released by the synaptic vesicles, and it had an effect on the muscle cell, namely to cause a depolarizing potential to get it up to threshold. It had that effect only because the skeletal muscle has the right kind of receptors to recognize that specific type of ligand, that neurotransmitter. That's why we called those receptors ligand-gated sodium ion channels, right? The ligand itself was the acetylcholine. That's true for all signals, though. They will do nothing if there isn't a receptor specific for that. Just like, unless you have the right lock, a key is not going to do you any good. Right? And this is why, for instance, when hormones are broadcast throughout the body, rather than just acting locally like a neurotransmitter, Many parts of the body don't respond at all. That's because those tissues don't have the right type of receptor for that hormone. So you can broadcast this signal all through the body, and only certain tissues will respond to it, those that have the right kind of receptor. Okay, so anytime we're talking about signals, we have to be talking about receptors as well to receive those signals, whether it's hormones or neurotransmitters. And we've already talked about the fact that there is a preganglionic and a postganglionic neuron, whether we're talking about parasympathetic or sympathetic division. And therefore, there are two places at which neurotransmitter is released in both of those two divisions, right? We've also already even named the neurotransmitters. Hopefully you remember that. In all cases of autonomic preganglionic neurons, all cases meaning whether it's parasympathetic or sympathetic, the preganglionic neuron, the first one in series, always releases as its neurotransmitter acetylcholine. We've already mentioned that. That means that the postganglionic neuron, whether you're talking about sympathetic or parasympathetic division, all autonomic postganglionic neurons, in other words, must have receptors that are specific for acetylcholine. Otherwise, the message wouldn't be received. We call receptors that are able to recognize acetylcholine cholinergic receptors. We use that same word, cholinergic, C-H-O-L-I-N-E-R-G-I-C. The cholin part, just like in acetylcholine, that's where it comes from. And the erg part refers to responding, or causing, actually. But anyway, that same word, cholinergic, is used to describe a receptor that responds to acetylcholine and to a neuron that releases acetylcholine as its neurotransmitter. So by this definition I just gave you, that means that all autonomic preganglionic neurons are cholinergic neurons because they all release acetylcholine as their neurotransmitter. Okay? And all postganglionic neurons in the autonomic nervous system feature at their dendrites cholinergic receptors. Right? They have to have receptors in order to make sense of that acetylcholine. So just keep in mind that that same word describes both neurons that release the chemical and receptors that receive the chemical. Now at the other end, the postganglionic end, remember that there are two possibilities. The postganglionic neuron can release either acetylcholine also or norepinephrine, NE. And look at the shading. Green represents parasympathetic. Salmon represents sympathetic. So A, and it's also labeled in case you can't tell the difference between green and salmon. Parasympathetic, in all cases of the parasympathetic division, the postganglionic neuron releases acetylcholine as its neurotransmitter. That means all postganglionic parasympathetic neurons are cholinergic. Now, in order for the information not to stop there, in order for it to, the ultimate goal, which is to cause some effect in the effector organ, that means parasympathetic effector organs have to feature cholinergic receptors so that they can receive that second burst of acetylcholine from the postganglionic cell and respond appropriately. Okay? In the sympathetic division, it depends on the actual circuit. The postganglionic neurons. Some of the parasympathetic division's postganglionic neurons are cholinergic and therefore release acetylcholine. This is the minority of sympathetic postganglionic neurons. Mostly the ones that innervate sweat glands. There are some other exceptions as well, but many of these few postganglionic sympathetic neurons that are cholinergic are innervating sweat glands. Almost all of the other sympathetic targets or effector organs have adrenergic receptors. Now, adrenergic is the name we give to either the receptor that is able to recognize norepinephrine, or for that matter, epinephrine. But we use that same word, adrenergic, to describe a neuron that releases either epinephrine or norepinephrine as its neurotransmitter. And why do we call it adrenergic? Everyone hear that? Of course not.
Adrenaline.
Right. Adrenaline is another name for epinephrine, remember. And they both really mean the same thing, above the kidney, which is where the gland that produces adrenaline or epinephrine is situated. Well, when adrenaline or epinephrine are released from the adrenal glands, that's acting as a hormone. Here, well, noradrenaline and norepinephrine are also released by the adrenal gland as a hormone. Here, though, that same exact chemical, norepinephrine, is being used as a neurotransmitter. But still, that's why we call the neuron adrenergic, because it's releasing either adrenaline or noradrenaline, the alternative names for norepinephrine and epinephrine. Okay, so any given neuron in the autonomic nervous system is either cholinergic, releasing acetylcholine, or adrenergic, releasing norepinephrine. Any receptor in a postganglionic neuron is cholinergic, because the only neurotransmitters released by the preganglionic neurons is acetylcholine. Target tissues of the autonomic nervous system are either cholinergic, including all the target tissues of the parasympathetic division, because all postganglionic parasympathetic fibers are themselves cholinergic, or adrenergic, including most of the target tissues of the sympathetic division, because most of the postganglionic sympathetic fibers are adrenergic as well. Okay? The rest of them, like I said, the sweat glands mostly, those have to be cholinergic receptors. I should also say that there are subclasses of these receptors. So there are two major types of cholinergic receptors. There are two major types of adrenergic receptors. Cholinergic receptors, there are two major categories, are nicotinic receptors and muscarinic receptors. These are named for the chemicals that also can cause them to act as receptors. Nicotine, they noticed, also can affect the things that they named nicotinic receptors. Muscarin comes from mushrooms, which is what muscarin really means. And so that's why they called those receptors that. So what this means, and really the main importance for knowing that there are different types of receptors for the same chemical, for the same neurotransmitter, is that two different tissues can respond completely differently to the same signal for a variety of reasons, really. But one of those reasons is the two different tissues could have two different subtypes that are both cholinergic receptors. And one subtype causes some sort of reaction and the other one causes some other effect. See what I'm saying? Well, the same is true for adrenergic receptors. There are alpha adrenergic receptors and beta adrenergic receptors. And they don't operate the same way, and they're housed in different tissues and therefore can cause different effects. All right, I don't think I need to go through table 15.4 on slide 11 because I just talked about all of this, but that's there for you to study with. So let's go to 12. And in 12, we can see a diagram that illustrates the notion of dual innervation. Dual innervation is a major feature of the autonomic nervous system. What do you suppose that phrase indicates?
Innervation.
What is innervation? Everyone understand? You know what innervation means. We've talked about this before. What does it mean to innervate? It means to connect a nerve to innervate. Nerve is in that word. So when a neuron makes a connection to some tissue, which could be another neuron, by the way, but if something has a neuron connected to it, that something is innervated. Motor neurons innervate skeletal muscles, for instance, in the somatic motor division. The viscera are innervated by the autonomic nervous system. Dual innervation refers to the fact that many of the target tissues of the autonomic nervous system, many but not all, are dually innervated, meaning they are innervated by the sympathetic division and separately by the parasympathetic division. So both divisions send fibers independently to the same target tissues. And this should make sense to you based on something I told you last time, namely that a lot of tissues that the autonomic nervous system controls are increased by one of the divisions in activity and decreased in activity by the other division. So for both of those divisions to exercise some sort of control over that tissue, they have to innervate that tissue. All right? And so this allows for very tight control of those tissues that are actually dually innervated. Because you're basically, the ultimate effect is going to be the sum of the outputs of the two divisions. Whichever one wins out, basically, is going to going to determine what the effect is on that tissue. I said that that's true on many of the tissues, so it's not a global aspect of the autonomic nervous system. There are some things that are innervated by only the sympathetic division and not the parasympathetic division. But here, in slide 12, we're seeing an example of a tissue or target tissue that is dually innervated. And when you have dual innervation, usually what you have functionally is antagonism, right? So the way that one of the divisions affects the tissue is opposite to the way the other tissue affects it. But remember, don't think about it as being sympathetic is always in one direction and parasympathetic is always in the other direction. It depends on the tissue, right? Sympathetic increases some tissues, decreases activity in other tissues, and the same is true for the parasympathetic division. So the example tissue here is the iris of the eyeball. The iris is pigmented so that it can absorb some light to protect you. That's what gives you your eye color. But the iris is a set of ringed muscles, a ring-like set of two major muscle bundles that besides absorbing light, their activity as muscles is to adjust the diameter of the pupil, and therefore automatically adjust the amount of light entering the eyeball depending on light availability. Right? The pupil is not a structure. The pupil is just a hole in the middle of the iris. Well, it looks, if you look at it, it looks like it's just one ring of muscles, but it's really two rings of muscles. And they are concentrically arranged, meaning they share the same center, but they're like zones on an archery target, right? One of them is farther away from the pupil, one of them is right around the pupil. So the one that is right around the pupil is the pupillary constrictor. And it's so called because it's able to constrict or narrow the pupil. It makes the pupil smaller, the opening smaller. So you would have that operate when? When? Right, when there's a lot of light. You want to close down the opening so not too much light enters the eye and damages it. The pupillary constrictor, that ring of muscle, any muscle has grain corresponding to the myofibrils, how they're arranged, right? The pupillary constrictor is a ring of muscle with circumferential grain going around in a circle. And therefore, when those sarcomeres shorten, the whole ring gets smaller because the overlap increases this way. Okay? So remember, muscles don't push, they can only get shorter. When this one shortens, though, that's going to cause the pupil to get smaller. The other ring, which is a bigger diameter ring that's all the way around that constrictor ring, is the pupillary dilator, so named because it dilates the pupil, makes it bigger. Well, that ring of muscle has grain that is radially arranged along radii, right, going from center to the circle itself. And so when all of those shorten, it makes that ring thinner and therefore pulls the whole inner ring along with it and opens up the pupil. These are antagonistic actions, dilation of the pupil or constriction of the pupil. And notice that dual innervation does this job. There is sympathetic and parasympathetic innervation here. And then notice that the parasympathetic fibers, the blue ones, are the ones that control the constrictor part of the iris. Whereas the golden sympathetic ones control the dilator muscle. Okay? So that's why it's listed as adrenergic stimulation, because that postganglionic sympathetic fiber that actually directly innervates the pupillary dilator is itself adrenergic, which means it releases norepinephrine. Whereas, of course, the parasympathetic postganglionic neuron is cholinergic, like all parasympathetic neurons are. And so it releases acetylcholine. So these things are undoing each other, right? They're antagonistic, but there's also dual innervation. And notice that these neurons don't travel side by side. They're not members of the same nerve, which happens often as well in the autonomic nervous system. So the parasympathetic fibers are part of the oculomotor nerve, number 3. Now, the oculomotor nerve does other things besides that, right? But some of those neurons that make up the overall bundle that we call the oculomotor nerve are parasympathetic fibers that go to the iris, whereas the sympathetic fibers that go to that same iris but to a different place are members of a totally different nerve. Okay, let's see whether we can finish this up. I think 13 is the last slide. So that was an example of dual innervation with antagonistic control. But like I said, there are some tissues that are innervated only by the sympathetic division. And we're seeing an example of that here. Blood vessels are lined by smooth muscle. And you already know that smooth muscles are targets of autonomic nervous system. And the reason that blood vessels are lined by smooth muscle is so that the diameter of those blood vessels can be changed, just like the diameter of the pupil, as the needs require. So we are never sending blood to all parts of the body at one time. There's not enough blood to go around. If we opened up all the pipes at once, it would be like everyone opening up, flushing the toilet at once in the entire city. That would put us into shock. That would drastically decrease the blood pressure, which is shock. And you could die from that. So the blood is sent to one tissue, you know, some tissues and not other tissues. And then the other tissues get the blood and the original ones don't. So it's switching off all the time. And not all of them get equal shares because they don't demand the same amount of blood. Right? The brain gets a lot of blood flow because it has to have a continuous supply of glucose to power it. We shut down blood flow to the skin sometimes when we don't want heat transfer to occur across the skin, right? When you're cold, you don't want to dump that heat from your body that your metabolism is producing out into the cold exterior. Well, you will do that if you send warm blood to the surface, which is where that coldness is. So you shut down the cutaneous vasculature so that you can keep warm, keep that blood in your core. Of course, you can't shut down blood to any tissue permanently because that tissue will die. So it's always changing. There needs to be a way to adjust blood flow. And so you can have either vasoconstriction, which means narrowing of the blood vessels, or vasodilation, widening of the blood vessels. And of course, vasoconstriction reduces blood flow, reduces perfusion. Perfusion refers to the flow of blood through a tissue, through the capillaries that serve a tissue. So something that is getting a rich supply of blood is being perfused. Vasoconstriction reduces perfusion. Dilation increases perfusion. Well, unlike the constriction and the dilation of the pupil, this is not dual innervation. This only the sympathetic fibers innervate the smooth muscles that control vascular diameter. And so there isn't as fine a control as there would be with dual innervation, but there still is control. You simply need to adjust how much squeezing is done by these same muscles. Okay, so you send them a signal that says, squeeze a lot, that's going to cause vasoconstriction. You send them a signal that says, not so much, they're not going to squeeze as much, and the blood pressure is just going to open up the blood vessel. So it's kind of like the difference between... Thought I had a good example in mind. Remember, though, I've talked about this before, too. All action potentials are the same magnitude, right? So the sympathetic division cannot tell the muscle cells to slow down by sending weak action potentials, or not to slow down, to vasodilate by sending weak signals, and to vasoconstrict by sending strong signals. All the signals are the same strength, right? So strength of stimulus is encoded by the nervous system in general, not just in the sympathetic division. Strength of stimulus is encoded as frequency of action potentials. That's why you see a lot of tick marks, each representing action potentials. A high frequency of action potentials occurring when the sympathetic output is high, that tells them, I mean, that stimulates the muscle over and over and causes it to contract a lot. That's going to cause vasoconstriction. Whereas a much lower frequency is going to cause vasodilation. Yes, we're done. We're not done. We're done with that chapter.